This podcast is brought to you by A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated. By the Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, Grand Bend to Port Rowan, come together to worship and serve. And by Molly Maid. Make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today. In this episode, we welcome back speaker, writer, public theologian, and immigrant advocate Karen Gonzalez. Karen's second book, which was recently released, is titled Beyond Welcome, Centering Immigrants in Our Christian Response to Immigration. This book seeks to elevate the discourse in the church beyond hospitality to immigrants. Many Christians have good intentions, working hard to welcome immigrants with hospitality and solidarity, but how can that be done in a way that empowers our immigrant neighbors rather than pushing them into the fringes of white dominant culture and keeping them as outsiders? That's exactly the question Karen Gonzalez explores in Beyond Welcome, and the question we'll explore in this episode of The Vicar's Crossing.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever and wherever you may be tuned in. We welcome you back to another edition of the Vicar's Crossing podcast. If this is the first time you've kind of jumped in and checked us out, welcome. So glad you're here.
Thanks for coming.
And we're thrilled you're being a part of it. My name is Rob Henderson, and I'm the rector of Holy Trinity St. Stephen's Anglican Church in London.
Hello, Vicar.
Hello.
My name is Kevin, and I am the rector of St. Aidan's Anglican Church in the northwest corner of London. Not near Moose Jaw, but that's where I am.
All right. And we are the Vicars, and the Vicar's Crossing is a virtual space where faith intersects with the public square. And we usually intersect with our good friend Ian, producer Ian, but he can't be with us today.
He works for a living,
he's
Rob.
He's back in the spirit, making sure we look good.
That's right.
We look good for YouTube and other...
He will have been an integral part of this by the time it gets to your eyeballs and your ears.
Yeah,
but right now he's out earning some coinage. He's a working man.
And hey, we're into our eighth season.
Yes.
Who would have thought?
Yeah.
Our fifth episode, and today on the Vicar's Crossing, we are excited to welcome back to the podcast. We had such a good time chatting with Karen Gonzalez that Karen has come back again, and she's got a new book out, and a speaker and writer and public theologian and immigrant advocate. And her new book is called Beyond Welcome, Centering Immigrants in Our Christian Response to Immigration. Mm-hmm. And a great book that really will equip us to take some action to, you know, dismantle white supremacy and xenophobia in the church, which does exist in many forms. But Karen's done a great job of kind of broadening that out for us and fleshing it out. So we're going to talk to Karen about that.
Indeed. And speaking of white supremacy and the need to dismantle it, we will begin, as we always do here, with our land acknowledgement, as we want to acknowledge that the land upon which we record this podcast are indeed the traditional lands of the Anishinaabeg, the Haudenosaunee, Lenape, Awak, and Attawandaran peoples. These are towns, our lands connected, pardon me, with the London Township and Somber Treaties of 1796 in a dish with one spoon confident wampum. This land continues to be home to diverse indigenous peoples whom we recognize as contemporary stewards of our land and vital contributors of our society, and people with whom we wish to walk hand in hand towards the path of reconciliation.
A big thank you, as always, to our sponsors on the Vicar's Crossing, to A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated. Dave Mullen is a great friend and supporter, and we give him many, many thanks for continuing with us. Yeah,
he's. I was hearing about a podcast earlier, Rob, called The Deadly Uncles. It's an indigenous podcast. It's two guys and their uncles to a lot of bands. So they've called their podcast. I'd encourage people to go check it out. I listened to a little bit of it. It's great. It's called Deadly Uncles, and I was thinking, Dave Mullen, he's like the deadly funeral director. He's the deadly funeral director, that guy. He's the guy. So speaking of deadly people, we have a deadly bishop. We have a deadly funeral director and a deadly bishop, Todd Townsend, Bishop of the Diocese of Huron. Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Grand Bend to Owen Sound to Port Rowan, and to all points in between, including London, Ontario, come together to worship and to serve. And Rob and I are grateful to be priests in this diocese and grateful to our bishop and the people for supporting this ministry we have here.
Yes, thank you so much. And to Molly Maid, make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today. Many thanks to Tricia Listar for her great support. And we say hi to all the team out and about at Molly Maid today.
Yep. If you're in your little Molly Maid car today listening to this podcast, this one's for you. And I'd like to give a special shout out to Tricia for coming back from Manhattan with a nice bobblehead Jesus for the dash of my vehicle.
Oh, there you go. Good, good. Very, we all very, need a good bobblehead Jesus.
Well, especially from Manhattan.
Especially from Manhattan. That's great. Well, Karen's here. And so we're going to bring Karen into the podcast and talk about the book and immigration and much, much more.
I will have to say, because the book is called such, you know what? She's beyond welcome.
And here she is back with us again for the second time in the Vicar's Crossing podcast. Karen Gonzalez, great to see you again. And how are things in Baltimore? How have you been keeping the last couple of years? We haven't talked to you for a bit.
Things in Baltimore are good. They're coming to an end, though. I'm moving to Mexico City in 3 weeks.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So, yes. This is why my background is blurred, because it is a mess of boxes and all kinds of stuff.
I was
going to
say, you're living in boxes. Yeah, been there.
3 weeks you're moving?
Wow.
3 weeks, yes. Okay. So, April 1st is my departure date. So, yes, I'm going to the vet tomorrow morning to get my cat's paperwork.
Oh, wow. Well, holy smokes. And what's waiting in Mexico City? You got something lined up there? Or?
Yeah, so I'm going to be working. The company that I work for has a big office in Mexico City. Okay. So I'm going to be working from that location. And on a personal level, I also want to connect. The company that I work for addresses a lot of the issues that drive migration.
Yeah.
And so they work really to provide economic and educational opportunities for people, for young people to stay in their country.
Awesome.
And I want to connect with a lot of the work that's happening in central Mexico with migrants, particularly from Central America. So that's kind of my own personal reason, but there's a work reason.
Good. Congratulations. That sounds exciting and a new chapter and more breaking news again, folks, on the Vicar's Crossing.
Yep.
Yes.
Breaking news. Karen's moving to Mexico City. Yeah.
And
you heard it here first.
And that means, by the way, the next time we have Karen back, we will have ventured into Mexico as well.
Yes.
So,
right.
So that's going to be very important. We've gotten to the UK and, you know, we've Canada and the US, but we really need to have somebody on while she's in Mexico. So
our Mexican correspondent, City correspondent.
Yes. All right. Well, that's a decidedly bigger city than Baltimore. We're just glad that you've taken time to be with us. This book of yours, and I'm just knocking all the stuff off of on my desk here, Beyond Welcome, is so good. It's such a good book. Couldn't encourage people to read it enough. I just love the way you write, Karen. It was the same thing when I read God Who Sees. I just couldn't put it down. It's so personal and yet so global in terms of the need for us all to hear the stories and also to be challenged to be more. Really, the book is calling for us to go beyond the superficiality that we talk about when we use the word hospitality or diversity, right? We like to talk about diversity in the church, but we really just mean, you know, how many brown faces do we have and that sort of thing, right? There's not a lot behind it sometimes. At the very outset of the book, you write about your own experience and about the myth of assimilation. So I wanted to start there around this myth of assimilation. You wrote this, and you were writing about your experience of being a teacher at the time. And you say, nobody taught me to assimilate to the white dominant culture of the United States, but I unconsciously adapted survival skills. Life became easier when I erased parts of myself and revealed only the parts that fit with the culture's comfort levels and expectations. When I spoke Spanish to my cousin at high school football game, angry fellow students yelled, "This is America, speak English." So I did. I was angry, but I became much more cautious about speaking my heart language publicly. When white classmates returned from Christmas vacation boasting of trips to California or the mountains of North Carolina, I did not share about our family Christmas in Guatemala of marimbas and fireworks. And when a white friend laughed hysterically at Howard Stern playing Selena's music alongside of a track of gunshots while Stern mocked her death, her music, and her fans, I pretended I found it amusing too. at that time you're teaching and you describe wanting your fellow teachers to see you as one of them and a pressure you felt to be that way. The implication is that, you know, if you don't assimilate in this world, at least in the cultures that we have here in North America, a lack of assimilating is failure. That if you don't assimilate, you're not going to get ahead, right? You're not going to advance. The next things aren't going to come. I wonder if you can share with our viewers, with our listeners, a little bit about just how that personally affected you, your dignity, your sense of self. And I sense that that's a part of where this book comes from, is this place of knowing we've got to get beyond these superficial words.
Yes, definitely. And that's, I really wanted people to know that assimilation is not a good thing, yeah, because it's often sold that way, mm-hmm, that people must assimilate or go home, yes, something to that effect. Yeah. And I wanted them to know that that's not the only way, because the way that it affects you is that, you know, as an immigrant person, you live in two different worlds, the world of your home with your heritage language and culture, and then you live in the outside world of North America, whatever that might be. And what starts to happen is that you start to see the way that your sort of private culture, I guess, isn't valued, isn't accepted, even though that is an important part of who you are. Mm. That is where you come from. And so you start to separate from that too. And that's not just a separation of culture and language, but also of your own family. Mm. You start to really disdain your own family, your own background, your own history. And when you experience that, like when people, you know, at school, when I started to notice these things, I started to, not consciously, but definitely unconsciously, believe, well, English is superior and American ways are better than Guatemalan ways. And it really does affect your sense of self. Mm. Your sense, it's a kind of self-hatred that enters in, because this is who you are. All of a sudden, who you are isn't okay. It's only okay to reveal the part that you've adapted to outside of your home. You end up with this sort of divided self because you've learned from the culture. You've kind of absorbed it. No one has said it, but you have absorbed that all of you is not okay. Only parts of you are acceptable, and it's only the parts that have adapted to the U.S. And so this is really harmful to your sense of self. And for me as a teacher, I ended up perpetuating that with my own students because I thought it was really the only way to be. And I didn't want them to experience rejection from the culture. Right. And so I tried to encourage them in this as well.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I just think about that. I mean, and as I read it too, like this sense of like, it just takes away your dignity, you know, it's like, mm-hmm, and the pressure to have to, as you say, even consciously or otherwise pass that on to others, you know, this notion that this is what you need, you know, and it, and it's all rooted, of course, in white supremacy. Assimilation, mm-hmm, is really just that. It assumes that the white host culture is superior. And that we must shake off inferior cultures to belong. You are advocating for a Christian response in the books, which would be decidedly different, a response where responding to immigration will be making room for newcomers to be integrated, but not pressured to assimilate. Like, there's a difference between integration and assimilation. A Christian response would fully recognize that people are allowed to bring their full selves into every space. You write about language and music, etc., not being a threat to the host country's way of life, as the newcomers value integration as much as the native citizens do. Everybody wants integration. So being a good advocate or an ally in that case means more than just saying, oh, we as a church value diversity. We have to go a layer deeper, yeah?
Exactly. And that can be hard for, mm-hmm, people. It's easier to say, I value diversity, than to actually change worship practices to reflect, mm, that, right? The desire can be there, but the discomfort may still be really strong. for people. And so I understand that it's a challenge, but I think we have to do that. Part of that, you know, is not just, oh, I want to see Black and brown people seated in the church sanctuary, but I want to see their cultures and who they are reflected. And so that may mean different ways of communicating, right? That may mean different worship practices. And all of that can be uncomfortable for mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. Yeah. because it means giving up control, giving up power, and sharing, right? Mm-hmm. Sharing different ways of doing things. And it's the exact same thing in the culture, allowing people to be mm-hmm. who they are and not, you know, forcing them, right, yeah. to give up everything in order to be accepted. Mm-hmm. And yet this is, I think, what happens a lot. And sometimes people will tell me, you know, I'll go speak at a church or a conference or something, and somebody will stand up and say, well, you know, my grandparents were Hungarian, let's mm-hmm. say, mm-hmm. and, you know, they did fine. And I often yeah. ask these people, well, do you speak Hungarian or Italian or whatever language? And often they don't. And I said, well, a large part of that is because your grandparents were pressured to give that up.
That's right.
And what I'm saying is that's not fair. No matter where people come from, we should encourage them to hold on to their cultures and their languages and their music, that there's nothing that's not going to prevent people from being able to integrate into the culture. People want to learn English, and people, they want to, because that helps them to navigate this culture more easily, right?
Absolutely. And I think that, like, that business, though, of the sharing is the part that, on a cultural level, I think is what feeds all the anger from what is white supremacy. Like, it's like this fear that you've got to give something up. Like, mm-hmm. what are we giving up? It's simply making space. You know, as Christine Paul writes about making room, right? Like, it's making room for more. It's not about, somebody losing something. It's about bringing more diversity and true diversity, you know, and an inclusion, as you say. It's really beautiful what you put in there.
It's abundance and not scarcity.
Yeah, it makes me think too, Karen, you're saying that about, you know, being in church and language and stuff like that, that, you know, Kevin and I come from and exist in an Episcopal or Anglican liturgical context. And it makes me want to be more cognizant in listening to the words we're saying in our liturgy every week, especially when I'm looking out. And, you know, I have a couple of parishioners that are from Jamaican descent and this sort of thing. And sometimes I wonder if these words that came from England are
colonizing words.
Yeah, exactly. In many respects are not being true to their needs and understandings as well. And it has to be an understanding and a cognizance of that. But that's a lot of work to do, definitely.
Yeah.
But it's important.
It is. It's a lot of work, and it's hard work. And unfortunately, I can tell you that a lot of people, because I remember my grandmother would encourage me when I first started learning from her about Jesus, and I would memorize from passages in Spanish from the Bible. Mm. She would tell me English was better and to memorize them in English.
Right.
So to a certain extent, people internalize that sense of, you know, this culture is superior or this language is better.
Right.
And it's important to fight that, you know, and to let people know it's not true.
Yeah. Well, I was brought up to think Jesus spoke in red letters, and I never understood what that meant. But there we go.
You and Shane Claiborne, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. one of the things we love so much about the book is that it is, you know, persistent in the dispelling of myths. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that. There's the myth of the good immigrant, right? That we need to be aware of. You write this in the book: good immigrants, according to the American mythology, work hard and they keep their heads down, never dreaming of accessing public benefits. They are eternally grateful for admission to this great country and never critique it. They speak English fluently without an accent and fully assimilate into American culture, forgetting the old country except in the occasional nostalgic moment or holiday. They do the jobs nobody else wants to do, which means they are essential but invisible. They are so law-abiding as to be above approach. In short, immigrants are shining examples of what it means to be American. Above all, good immigrants manage to maintain legal status amid an ever-shifting legal landscape that favors some of the marginalized, favors some and marginalizes others, leaving many stranded in the world of loopholes and technicalities, leaving families hungry and in danger, separated and unsure of their future. Some might even go so far as to say that the good immigrants will see their children starve before they will cross the border without papers. Mm. It's a mythical status of perfection that no one can achieve. And this is, you know, no different here in Canada. And yet the history of this continent reveals that the immigrants who arrived in earlier centuries did not migrate here to become good Canadians or, you know, show up to be good Americans. Mm. They certainly did not assimilate to the ways of the indigenous peoples of the lands that we are upon. Those newcomers wanted to replicate the best parts of the old country and what they believed would be better circumstances. You know, we're aware that we live in the city of London, but it's called London for a reason. Nova Scotia or New Scotland and New York, as place names testify to the desires of the hearts of the earlier settlers. So, you know, you make the case that immigrants have not changed, but immigration laws have. Mm-hmm. And those changes have made room for the myth of the good immigrant. Can you say a little bit more about this, especially in light of how the church participates in this myth too?
Yes, definitely. And yeah, this is something that I pick up often. You know, just the day I was looking through Facebook this morning and a friend shared about the death of his father. And he said, one of the things he said was, my father migrated legally and brought his family here legally. Mm-hmm. And this was a part of the goodness of his father, he felt. Right. And so to me, you know, I did not respond in any way other than to give my condolences. But my thought was, somehow my friend has learned that people won't think his father is as good because he doesn't clarify his father migrated legally, right?
Yeah.
When in reality, the fact that he lost his father is a tragedy no matter what.
Yeah.
It's like asking someone, you know, whose parent died of cancer if they smoked. Like, right. It doesn't matter if they did or not. The fact is this person has lost, right? Mm-hmm. A loved one, and that's what matters in this moment. And so it's very subtle the way this gets perpetuated in the church, but one of the ways that I see it most is the stories that get told and mm-hmm. centered. And so there'll be a story shared, you know, this happened at my church. They had a focus on World Refugee Sunday, an evangelical church that I was a part of a few years ago. And of course, they tell these stories about incredibly, you know, hardworking people, and they're a family, of course, and this is what they do, and this is how they serve, you know, how they're a part of the community. And I just saw it again on Sunday when the winner of the Best Supporting Actor for the Oscars, mm-hmm. for the, you know, American Academy Awards, people were saying things like, see, we should welcome refugees, as if mm-hmm. refugees have to be extraordinary to be worthy of inclusion, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so these are the subtle ways that these messages get communicated when most refugees live very ordinary lives, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Their lives are worthy, right?
Yeah.
They're worthy of dignity, they're worthy of care, inclusion, just as they are. And so I fear that sometimes the way we tell stories or whose stories we choose to tell often communicate that there are good kinds and bad kinds, right? And we wouldn't tell the story of what we believe is a bad kind of immigrant. And I think I shared in the book an example of a time I kind of experimented with this, telling the story. And, you know, people were not sympathetic to that. And it was really interesting to me how they wanted to hold this person to a standard that many of them couldn't even meet.
Exactly.
but suddenly an immigrant isn't worthy unless they can meet all of these requirements that people have deemed. And a lot of them are in that list that you read, right? This is how they have to be in order to be worthy.
I see it in the refugee work that we've done, even here at St. Aidan's, in my previous church as well. As long as we're willing to tell the story of refugees we've brought from previously Kuwait, now Syria, now Afghanistan, you know, if they've done well, we need to share those stories. And even on a diocesan level, as we try and get more churches involved, we downplay, you know, the messiness of it to uphold the best examples, as if it's somehow, that telling the truth. And you're right, people are not receptive to it, because telling the truth that perhaps a family trying to adjust from leaving behind everything they ever knew because it got blown to bits and coming here and perhaps living through that post-traumatic experience never really find a way to get integrated and are struggling even 3, 4, 5 years in and perhaps are on social assistance and all of that stuff. That's not the story they want to hear. They want to hear about, you know, the Syrian family who came here and opened up a shawarma shop, right? So that's the good immigrant, right?
They did well.
You know, they're contributing.
Yes, they're a credit now to the country
contributing to our society, you know.
Yes. Yeah. And I think we can do that in the church, but we have to choose to talk about the fact that humanity, being a human, means that we're messy and that our stories are complicated. And this is true of all humans. You know, I talk in the story about, in my book, about some of the stories around my family that I didn't think were okay to tell, including that we were undocumented. Because I learned very quickly that this was not okay for a lot of people. And so it was important not to share that part of the story, because that makes you not a good immigrant, not the kind that people really want. And so, and I think this is a way that we also instill shame in immigrant communities by having these standards that we don't talk about. Mm-hmm. And so in the book, I talk about Rahab, because to me, you know, Rahab is this, she's a sex worker. And he is someone who, whose life, you know, was probably very complicated. She was someone marginalized. And yet it's interesting that the scripture never makes any kind of judgment about her. It tells her story, and she's the one with agency in the whole chapter of her story. And it's interesting the way that the whole narrative is interrupted to tell the story of Rahab. Like, for some reason, this was noteworthy. It was important for us to know. And so this woman, as she is, the kind of person that you would think the Israelites would say, well, she's foreign, she's a sex worker, she's kind of a trickster, liar kind of person. Maybe she's not the kind of person we want, even though she helped us out. Maybe when we'll keep our promise to her, but we'll hide her in some corner. And that'll be her lot, you know, to keep our promise to her. But no, she lives with honor among them. She ends up marrying into their community, something she couldn't even do in her own community.
Right.
You know, and lives with honor. And I think this is just a really, for me, a really beautiful example of the way that God looks at hospitality and inclusion, right? It's full. She becomes family. And in family, things are messy. Stories are messy, you know, and I'm trying to work now on my third book, and it's a little bit different. It's a lot about my mom, and I'm having so much trouble getting a real story from different relatives, because they only want to tell you, you know, these good things, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But we get the whole messy story of Rahab. And I think that's an excellent model for us in, okay, you know, a refugee person. When I worked in an organization that worked with refugees, it was interesting because I asked the caseworkers, I'm like, so what's it like, you know, to work with refugees? And they said, oh, a lot of them are really kind of grumpy. A lot of them are really traumatized. And so sometimes they're not very patient. And, you know, they want access to these services so they can deal with their medical issues or mental health issues. And it wasn't at all what I expected, because I'm not someone that is not subject to these myths too. I thought they were going to say, oh, they're really grateful to be here. Oh, they're very happy that they're now in the U.S. No, they just said truth, you know? And if you think about it, if you had been through all the things that many refugees have been through, you might be really grumpy and sad and homesick and all of these things as well.
Yeah. Oh, when you think of the things that we do get grumpy about as Westerners sometimes, it's ridiculous, right? I had to wait 9 minutes in line for a coffee this morning. Are you kidding me?
Yes.
They can't speed it up a little bit?
How dare they complain about the level of income the government's supporting them with or whatever.
Crazy.
Crazy.
Words matter. You know, we've talked about that in the podcast before, and you in the book, you know, one of the critically important truths you point out is just how much words matter. And you reference some of the words that colonizers used to dehumanize, to devalue indigenous peoples of the Americas. And we certainly are learning more and more about the generation impact of those words here in Canada and how they've, you know, played out certainly in our country as well. And I think it's true to say that oppressors the world over understand that it is much easier to enslave and kill those who, you know, you don't see as human. You can take that off the table and it makes it easy for them. Dehumanizing people is one of the tools of the colonizer. And you're right about the terror attacks in El Paso, Texas. This was August of 2019. 23 people lost their lives and 23 injured. The shooter said that he feared the, quote, Hispanic invasion of Texas. Karen, you might not be aware, but here in London, Ontario, in the summer of June of 2021, we had a terror attack that took the lives of three generations of one family. They were run down by a pickup truck out for an evening walk, just, you know, a mile from where I'm sitting today. And their killer, when he was arrested, was spewing hatred toward Muslims and Middle Easterners. You know, these words have such power. Can you say more to us about the importance of our words, the need for us to unlearn some of the toxic words we've been using in order to learn new words that have the power to transform and to speak life, to speak freedom, and to really bring inclusion to our society?
Sure. Yeah. And this is, I think, really important. And it's something that all of us can do. And I don't say this at all to shame people, because I am still learning and unlearning too.
Yeah, all of us. Yeah.
There are things that I, you know, learn day by day about words that are life-giving and words that are not. And so for example, you know, here in the U.S., you'll hear a lot of people talk about illegals. Illegal is an adjective. It's not a it's not a noun. But you'll hear them talk about immigrants who don't have documents that way, who don't have the legal right to be here. And so it may not seem like a big deal, but when you label someone that way, those illegals, those homeless, those, you know, all of a sudden they're not humans. They're not human beings like me.
Right.
They've been reduced down to this one thing. You know, I was out in the Western U.S. and I heard there's a lot of homeless encampments, and I heard it a lot around that too. Oh, those homeless encampments. I'm like, well, those are human beings who live in these encampments, right? And the same thing with immigrants. If you just call people illegals, or you call people, you know, Donald Trump was a master of this.
Wow, yeah.
He would talk about things like the infestation, or this, you know, caravan, as if like armies were coming and attacking instead of a few thousand immigrants. So using language that humanizes, so that all of a sudden people aren't focused on human lives and our shared humanity, but on, oh, these are vermin of some kind that I don't want, you know, near me. And so it has a really powerful effect, and it's so insidious that people don't pick up on it, how harmful it is.
Right.
I think the El Paso example was just particularly tragic to me, because I went to El Paso and found out it used to be one city. Yeah. It was one city called El Paso. El Paso del Norte means the path, you know, the road to the north.
Yeah.
And what happened is the U.S. came after the Treaty of Hidalgo and they just sliced the city in half and said, well, this part belongs to us, that part belongs to you, and so you need to rename this part.
Yeah.
And that's how this city came about, just dividing a community arbitrarily, just deciding, you know, where the line was going to be. And so historically, you have a lot of indigenous Mexicans in that area who have been there for generations, and the That's border right. was created, you know, through their community.
Yeah.
And so to me, the fact that he was probably the invader historically, you know,
That's right.
mm-hmm. of the one who was the outsider in that community. And so this is the way that language works, though. It leads to actions like these. And so in the book, I also talk about some words that seem like they're not quite as bad. Like, you know, when people talk about we welcome refugees, it's a big slogan here, especially during the Trump era. But it's still focusing on we.
Yes.
Right? And refugees are still the object.
Yeah.
They're not the subject. They're receiving action.
Right.
From us. The focus is still on us and our posture rather than the refugees themselves. And so it can be problematic in that way too, because then what happens is you end up treating people as perpetual foreigners instead of your neighbors.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so this is why so many immigrant people get upset when we ask where we're from. It's not that we don't want to talk about where we're from.
Right.
It's because we're being told with that question, you're not from here, you don't belong here.
You're being
off the bat. Yeah.
The question itself is othering you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I think, you know, here, like I said, going back to the talk about refugee work that gets done in the church, you know, I remember one family in particular, they really balked against that word. And thankfully, you know, and you referenced this in the book as well, somebody at some point found a language to use the word newcomer here in Canada a lot. And that's how we try to speak of this now, because, you know, but we've seen it in those families themselves who are, they because they know there's a negative connotation to the word refugee. They know that's the thing. And I can't figure out how we haven't, you know, like, I mean, this is not new. This, you know, we saw it in the 30s in Europe when they dehumanized Jews, and it ended where it did. Is it? I mean, our settlement here in Canada and in the United States, and the way that Europeans referred to the indigenous people here, dismissed them and referred to them as savages and non-persons. In Canada, in fact, indigenous First Nations people were not considered people under the law until the 60s. They had no vote until the 1960s. I mean, it's shocking. They either had to choose, if they decided they wanted to vote in a Canadian election, they had to renounce their First Nations identity. So we have war heroes who came back from the Second
They could
war.
Go to war.
Yeah, we send them to war in World War II, and then they came back, and they couldn't receive the benefits, and their next and the generations down couldn't. And it's been fixed now, but it took up until the 90s for these families to be able to claim their status as First Nations, because their granddad went off to war for the country, and so he gave up being status. He's now a Canadian, and so he doesn't get any of the benefits of being, you know, indigenous to the land. So all of these things come from this sort of deleterious language, right? This sort of dehumanizing stuff. So, again, folks, you got to get a book. It's so good. The other thing you point out is the challenge we have as Christians to find a way to step back from what is an ethnocentric faith. Now, that is to say, stepping away from being certain that our way of doing things is the proper way, whoever the our is in that equation, while being blinded by the possibilities that could come with doing things differently. Our own comfort of community becomes a bias towards others. And you point out that one of the greatest obstacles to recovering from this sort of ethnocentric approach is the lack of realization that our expression of faith also carries a culture. There's culture in our faith, right? And pardon me, we're pretty good at recognizing that we may need to learn a new culture or a new language if we're in a new land. However, we usually stop short. We seldom realize that we must also learn a new way of seeing faith in the other context, that people express their faith in different ways. You point out that when we do not pay attention to how God has been present in another culture and how the Spirit is revealing God's very self in local cultural expressions, we will then impose our own Christian culture on others. And I couldn't help but think as I read that just about the whole colonizing experience of my own church, the Church of England here in Canada, when it landed here and disavowed everything that Indigenous spirituality was all about. Could you say more about this and offer a couple of really good biblical examples in that chapter, which I think are very powerful about the need for us to step back from this sort of ethnocentric reality and just see how beautifully God can reveal God's self in different ways.
Yeah. So it's interesting, you know, I wrote this book and then I spent this past summer in Guatemala and I decided to study the indigenous language from the region where my father is from in central Guatemala. And while I was there, I met some Americans who, you know, were doing different work, and some of that was church planting, some nonprofit or NGO kind of work, and they invited me to their church. And it was a church that was planted by a church in Dallas, Texas. And I was shocked because when I walked in, you would have thought I'd been transported. I walked through a portal and got transported back to the U.S. Nothing about it. The music was just translated into Spanish. The sermon was the exact same sermon the pastor in Dallas gave. And it was told in English and then translated in the, you know, simultaneous kind of translation during the sermon. So the examples, you know, were a lot of Western examples. There were sports analogies and things from sports teams in the U.S. And I was really shocked that when I asked questions about how is this contextual, they said, it's in Spanish. We give it in Spanish too. And I'm like, no, that's language.
But it's the two part. That's
right. And so I think that this happens a lot, not just in foreign missions, but it can happen here as well. And I think it's often where we don't locate ourselves properly in the scriptures. I don't know if you're on Twitter, but there's an ongoing debate right now about David and Bathsheba on Twitter.
Yeah.
It comes up every year, right, about whether or not Bathsheba was raped or she was a willing participant in an adulterous relationship with the king. And really, the way that you see that story really depends on your location, on your social location. If you are viewing it from the perspective of a woman in the ancient Near East, right, who had was not even considered a person, had no rights, had no, she was considered the property, right, of her father and then her husband. And then, but if you don't look at it that way, if you look at it and you put yourself in David's place, and that's who you identify with, right? Yeah. What you will do then is you will think of her, right, as this willing participant in the act. Even discounting, you know, who it was that was corrected and called out in that example. To me, it's an excellent example of ethnocentric reading, because what you're doing is you're reading it from your perspective and you're putting yourself in the place of someone who you're not, right? But really, if you were looking at this within that culture, I think it wouldn't be hard to see that Bathsheba had no agency or choice in this matter. You know, she was summoned and she was brought, and she wasn't, you know, if at the very least you would call it a power rape, because just because there wasn't violence doesn't mean that this was consensual when both the people don't have power. And so I see this, and I, in the book, I talk about the example of Joseph, of sometimes powerful men being accused of different things that are true and credible. And they will say they're like Joseph. They're being accused falsely. And Joseph is this vulnerable teenager who was trafficked to a foreign land and had no recourse, no power. And to put yourself in the place of that, it's just very problematic to not recognize how you are not Joseph. And so I see this so much, and especially in the way that we think about our countries as places of scarcity rather than abundance.
Abundance.
Right? We always, because we always identify, and this is a lot, again, an American person reading the Bible comes across the word, there was a rich person, they should know, that's me.
Yes, right.
I am the rich person, right? But no, instead they identify with poor in the Bible, which is the wrong placement for them. And then what that leads to is this sense of, oh, there isn't enough. I'm this poor person. There isn't enough in my country. What's going to happen? There's not going to be jobs for my children or whomever, right? Or for me. So things are being taken from me instead of seeing God's world as one of abundance. And I see this so much with the questions that I receive whenever I speak about this. And so it's really problematic. And unfortunately, there's a lot of very conservative and very influential leaders who promote this kind of ethnocentric thinking. Even, you know, one saying that people in Latin America aren't Christians.
Wow.
Because they're Catholic.
Right. Oh my God. I mean, we all know that Catholics are not Christians. Just ask my Catholic wife. She'll tell you all about it.
And it makes me wonder, you know, who do they think held the faith before the Protestant Reformation?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly. Wanted to talk a bit about hospitality. And it's important in the church. It's hard to conceive of a church that doesn't really think of itself as the most welcoming and hospitable place. It's so important, we even strike committees. We have a hospitality committee, right?
Yes.
Oftentimes we also know the truth that sometimes it's really far away from that. The hospitality of Jesus, though, is revolutionary, and it is life-changing. Ask the woman at the well that we had in our lectionary last Sunday that we were preaching on. Yeah. It is a reciprocal hospitality. Jesus not only offered hospitality, he also relied on the hospitality of others who offered, table fellowship and other.
Well, and
forms.
He says to that woman at the well, "You give me a drink."
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So we've come to understand hospitality to refugees and other immigrants that moves really only in one direction, right? From the native citizen with rights to the immigrant in need. And if we had the courage to change this, we could come to see hospitality in a new light. You know, we'd see it the way Jesus actually lived it. Hospitality that encouraged the host's humility and diminishes the impact of the, you know, the power dynamics that often exist when welcoming newcomers. And you, Karen, advocate for a reimagined hospitality for us in the church. Mia casa, esu casa is often used expression, even in the English world, to the point of being, you know, a bit cliche. And you break that down and tell people what the actual translation is. So can you say more about that for us and tell us more about how we might reimagine our hospitality, especially in the church?
Yeah, I think, you know, hospitality is one of those things that I think for most of us, you know, here in the U.S., you think about Martha Stewart. If you think about hospitality, a nice dinner party,
And it's good.
Right. Having your friends over. Yes. But in the scriptures, hospitality usually refers to strangers, to people or foreigners. And so it's a very different view. Not to say that there weren't problematic things in the ancient world as well with hospitality, but I think that when we think about hospitality to immigrants and refugees, it always moves in that one direction, right? We welcome refugees, right?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of thinking about, well, what do refugees have to offer me? They're human beings. They're made in the image of God too. They have faith, they have gifts, they have cultures and languages, right? And so, but often we see them not just as a refugee, just as an immigrant. So as someone who has less, somehow in every way, instead of just has less materially and maybe less knowledge of the culture, right? Or of the new language. And so That's what happens when hospitality only moves in one way. And so what I'm encouraging is for people to consider, how can hospitality move in both ways?
Yes.
So, and I think, you know, there's a writer, Danielle Mayfield. You may have interviewed her.
Not yet, but it's coming. We're going to do that. Yeah.
She talks a lot about how much she's learned from her refugee neighbors and how much, you know, they have enriched her life with their generosity, with their hospitality, their kindness, the way that she's learned about community from them. And this is what I mean. It's a, it's not just a thing of, I invite them to my house. Now, you know, they will invite me to their house. It's not that kind of hospitality, but it's a general posture, right? Of recognizing that, yes, a refugee person may be in need and maybe is newly arrived, but they have so much to offer. And I saw this with, you know, there was a, in Minnesota, there's a representative who is a Muslim refugee from Somalia. And when she went to Washington to serve as a representative, she said something, you know, about, you know, 25 years ago, I arrived with my family here as refugees, and now I'm returning to Washington, D.C., but this time I'm going to serve as representative of this district, you know. And to me, that's very reflective of the fact that, yes, there was a time when her family had a lot of needs, right? And she did too. But she is a human being made in the image of God, and she has a lot to offer as well. And if we could take that posture, I think some of the paternalism that's surrounding immigrant and refugee ministries, or even ministries with people experiencing homelessness or other kinds of, you know, ministries with people who are in vulnerable situations, I think it could really change the dynamics of those relationships toward more mutuality, more of a sense of connection with people, rather than seeing them as, oh, I can offer you this. I just read a really good book called Grace. Grace Can Call Us Home.
Yeah, Grace about, Can Lead Us Home.
Kevin Nye.
Grace Can. Yes. Yeah. So good. Yeah, I finished reading it recently and I really loved it. And one of the things that he shares in the book is that, you know how a lot of groups will have like a fancy dinner for board members and donors, right? So they had a fancy dinner for people experiencing homelessness in the community. Because, and they said everyone deserves a party, right? Not just the donors and the people that, you know, give us resources to make things happen, but why isn't there a party also for people who are experiencing homelessness? And I love that in the book. And that's that sense, right? They are human beings. They need celebrations too. You know, they need these joyful events as well, right? It's not just certain people.
It's that reciprocity. You know, we had Kevin and I on, and that book ended up being a subject of our whole deanery study here, because homelessness and the crisis around it here in the city is, and it is, it's that reality. I mean, I really think, you know, for in the Anglican context, we talk about our baptismal covenant a lot and about the promise that we'll seek and serve Christ in all persons, love neighbor as self, strive for peace and unity among all people. And then the key part there is respect the dignity of every human being. Well, there's no dignity if you're always ever only on the receiving end of a stance that you're the one that has to be looked after, right? I mean, and I think what Kevin is doing out there right now is, I mean, I see it lockstep with the work you're doing, Karen, because you're writing about it from the perspective of immigration. He's writing about it from the perspective of homelessness, but it's that same Jesus-focused theology to me around radical hospitality, you know, a radical nature of what can happen. Look, there's so much more in this book we'd love to get to, but we'd be here all day, and then you probably would never make it to Mexico City. And we don't. So, but just a couple of things before you go. One of them is around the place embracing new play. Or pardon me. One of them is around kingdom, and speaking about the nature of kingdom. Right. You referenced the work of scholar and theologian Ada Maria Diaz, who imagines the kingdom, and I'm, for those of you listening to this, or it's K-I-N apostrophe D-O-M, specifically not kingdom, but kingdom, She writes that she sees it not as a hierarchical monarchy with kings at the top and peasants at the bottom. It's more like the parable of the banquet, where all are invited and share the same table as equals. We no longer live in a world where kings rule the nations of the earth, you write, Karen. So rather than presenting God as a monarch with absolute power, Diaz presents a relatable horizontal kingdom. Her kingdom is a more personal vision that blends the ideas of flourishing or abundant life with familia, the sense of familia that we have in mind when we talk about God's family, and our sense of belonging and being safe and to become fully oneself. And this is the promise of joy of a new family whose members are united in the mission of Jesus. Diaz insists that we no longer have to promote a vision of the world that is white, cisgender, and heterosexual. Salvation, she says, liberation, and the coming kingdom of God are one and the same thing. We do not make the kingdom happen, but it requires us to take responsibility for making justice a reality in our world. You speak about this in the light of the parable of the banquet in your book. Can you say more about this vision of the familia de Deus? And my Spanish is terrible. I apologize.
That's okay.
And I, if I'm not mistaken, that's a phrase that we have Melissa Flora Brixler on here as well. And she writes about this too, yeah, about this familia de Deus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Say more about that, if you will. I know I was going to say as well that picking up on that, this is something I think we see here as well in Canada. It's this business of getting off of this notion that theologically God is up there and everything else is down here. And I really like Diana Butler Bass's book, Grounded, which speaks of that horizontal reality of the kingdom. Anyway, enough from me. Let's hear you talk about that.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. It's, you know, the ancient writers of the Bible, they were writing about their reality, and their reality was kingdoms.
Yes.
There were kings and the people below them, all around them. And so now we have different understandings, right, of the way the world can be organized. And so instead of doing this vertical, right, where someone's at the top, and that means that there are subjects, there are people on the bottom, we look at this banquet table, which is this vision, right, that you see in Isaiah as well, of the coming kingdom of God. And instead of having people seated, you know, in hierarchy, it's you can have anyone seated next to you.
Right.
And so it's this vision now of family, right? Where it's the same thing in your family. Anyone could be sitting next to you. It could be Black Sheep, Uncle Gus, or, you know, it could be anyone. And so this is the way that this is organized now, thinking of each other as part of the family of God. And so that's really what the kingdom is. Right, we are all kin rather than we are subjects, right?
Yes.
Of a king. And so I love that image and that way of thinking about each other, because it does promote that mutuality, that sense of it doesn't matter, right? What someone has or doesn't have, or what status they have or don't have. Right. It only matters that we are all part, we're kin, we're all part of the family of God. And so I love that. And I close the book with a prayer to the God of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And we're kind of hoping that you might offer that prayer as we kind of come to the end of our time with you today, Karen. This is, you know, really nice parts of the book. Each chapter concludes with a beautiful prayer that you have written. So would you maybe just to wrap up our podcast, if you have it there with you,
sure.
You know, to pray the God of the kingdom.
Sure. So God of the kingdom, you are the God of the great banquet who invites all of us to the table as part of your familia. You don't delight in hierarchies and pecking orders. We're prone to create them. We inadvertently decide some lives are more worthy than others. That is not the kingdom Jesus came to establish. He turned the world upside down and taught us to give without expecting to be repaid. to expect the humble places to be exalted in the end, and to accept the invitation we can't actually imagine is actually for us. Teach us to be part of your kingdom. We're tired of narratives that center the most comfortable representation for the dominant culture. We want to be unsettled from our comforts and spurred to love and to see as you do. We aren't waiting for your kingdom. We want to labor with you to build it. We want justice, kinship, liberation, and belonging. Don't let our hope falter in seeking this kingdom. Let us see you in the face of our neighbors. Amen.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. That's wonderful. Thank you for that. And thank you for gifting us with the book. We're so thrilled that we had a chance to touch base with you before you get out of Dodge and head down to Mexico City. And there it is, Beyond Welcome. Karen Gonzalez is the author and our guest today on The Vicar's Crossing. And Karen, we wish you God's blessing and all the best on your move too.
Thank you.
And again, our thanks to Karen, and we hope everybody gets out and picks up a copy of that book and orders it. Wonderful read, Beyond Welcome, Karen Gonzalez. And we'll look forward to talking to her from Mexico City next time
Amen
around.
To that.
That's great. I want to thank our sponsors today, to A. Miller George Funeral Home, where each life is celebrated, and their sister company, Cremation London Middlesex, both family-owned and operated, to the Diocese of Huron, a community where families and individuals from Windsor to Owen Sound, Grand Bend to Port Rowan come together to worship and serve. And of course, our good friends at Molly Maid, make your home a healthy haven. Call Molly Maid London today. That wraps up this edition of The Vicar's Crossing. I'm Rob Henderson from Holy Trinity St. Stephen's in London.
I'm Kevin George from over at St. Aidan's. And Rob, I just have a question. What's the over-under on whether Ian will be with us next week or not?
I don't know if there's an over and under. There's odds. I think they're given 2-1. So
2-1 on
that's
on
pretty
him,
good.
On him.
On him being here.
On him being here. Okay.
Yeah.
So I got to get out to MGM Bets or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I can get my bet in.
He'll be on there. Yeah. He'll be on there. That's great. Thanks, everybody, for checking us out. And we'll look forward to getting together again next time. Amen. Kevin, remember to always look both ways
before you cross the street.
Thank you for listening. Our hosts are Kevin George and Rob Henderson. Our producer and composer is myself, Ian, with original artwork done by Elizabeth Dodman. If you have any questions or want to know where to find us, tweet us at Vicar's Crossing or find us on Facebook at The Vicar's Crossing. If you have any other questions about anything heard on this podcast, leave us a comment or look in the description to find out more. Thanks!